Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and today we have on Robin Linkhart, who is also a host on Project Zion, and we are going to be talking about Community of Christ as a Peace Church. So how this idea came about is Robin and I, along with many others, were recently in Nauvoo, Illinois at family camp or reunion, and it was a historical reunion. That was the theme. For the 175th anniversary or commemoration of Joseph and Hiram's death in Carthage, Illinois. And over the course of the week, we focused on different points of history. There were different activities, story sharing, reenactments of Joseph's final public speech, etc. So one of the nights we had a panel with some of the actors that played some of those historical figures in the reenactments. And the panel just went over different stories and perspectives of that time period and then a little bit beyond with the reorganization with Joseph III, etc. And Robin played a part in that later in that worship service where she talked about Community of Christ being a peace church through the 21st century. So she kind of brought it up to modern day and just really showed the pathway that Community of Christ took to where we are today and how peace has always been part of our DNA. So I really enjoyed Robin's words, and we were a little bit short on time. And so I know that there was some stuff that she wasn't able to get to. And so I threw out the idea to have this conversation on Project Zion. So here we are. Thanks, Robin.
Hey, Brittany. It's fun to be on the podcast today and talk a little bit about Community of Christ as a peace church then and now, connected with our historical roots, but also kind of taking a high-level view of tracing how peace has really taken root in our movement and grown and borne much fruit. Before I get started, I want to recommend a couple resources because I'm not going to talk a lot about the early seeds, and I know there will be listeners who are keenly interested in that. I would recommend Lachlan Mackay's article, A Peace Gene Isolated, Joseph Smith III. You can find this in the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal, Volume 35, Number 1, Spring, Summer 2015. This was actually Locke's presidential address at the 42nd Annual John Whitmer Historical Association Conference, September of 2014. And he does a great job of really delving into Joseph Smith III and how Joseph nurtured those seeds of peace from our early history. There's also a book available on Amazon.com. It's called In Pursuit of Peace. And the authors are Andrew Bolton, John Hamer, David Howlett, Lachlan Mackay, and Barbara Walden. That's a fairly new publication and goes through a very thorough overview of how Community of Christ evolved from the early days of the church to who we are now, and the continuous focus and nurturing of our call to pursue peace. So I think we definitely can see seeds in early church history of peace. If we look at section 95 of the Doctrine and Covenants, which came about around the same time that we see Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon exampling this turning the other cheek, a common Christian approach to conflict when they were tarred and feathered. And in section 95, we read that the Lord's people are called to renounce war and proclaim peace. And then that's followed by counsel to bear the enemy's smite against you not once, not twice, but three times without seeking revenge. And then only after that would a defensive response be justified by the Lord. We see other seeds of peace in the Doctrine and Covenants in what's commonly called the Fishing River Revelation, which was given in June of 1834 when Zion's camp was forced to set up camp due to heavy rain and a hailstorm between two forks of the Fishing River on their way to Missouri. And that reads like this. This is the piece of that that I really like is, "Sue for peace, not only the people that have smitten you, but also to all people, and lift up an ensign of peace, and make a proclamation for peace unto the ends of the earth, and make proposals for peace unto those who have smitten you, according to the voice of the Spirit which is in you, and all things shall work together for your good. And lo, I am with you even unto the end." So we see these revelations coming to the early church in the midst of multiple conflicts and aggressive persecutions. And admittedly, the early church kind of forgets about these peaceful councils in the early years. And as we respond to multiple violence and oppression all around us. I think the evidence is really convincing that Joseph Smith III's exposure to violence throughout his childhood left him with this kind of firm resolve to walk in the way of peace. So the early seeds of peace were nurtured under his leadership, and you can see his resolve to this peaceful approach to living as a young adult in Nauvoo, even before he became the prophet president of the reorganization. This approach, nurtured by Joseph Smith III, held steady during the presidency of Fred M. Smith and Israel A., with some deepening in various degrees. And I think, especially under the presidency of Israel A. Smith, we begin to see some fanning of the flames of peace. Now, I would be one to say that if you want to really understand the movement and journey of Community of Christ, you could see that really poignantly if you want to read all the heralds from the time the Herald was first published. And of course, we had earlier publications that reflected what was going on in the life of the church before that. But another way to see how things are happening in the life of the church is to look at all the World Conference resolutions that we have passed in our World Conference gatherings. Of course, that used to be called General Conference. So under Israel A. Smith, we see three resolutions coming up, which I think reflect his leadership and the church's growing sensitivity and awareness to being peacemakers in our world. So World Conference Resolution 963 in 1948 was about racial equality. We see another one, number 976 in 1950, on racial equality. And then 6 years later, not too long before his death, we see 995 on racial integration. So following the death of Israel A., W. Wallace Smith was ordained prophet president in October 6, 1958. And simultaneous with that, a new era is emerging in the life of the reorganization.
So, Robin, I'm wondering what the significance of a World Conference resolution is. How does a World Conference resolution kind of trickle down to the culture of what we now know as mission centers and congregations? But at the time, I'm not sure how they administratively organize themselves, but how does a World Conference resolution kind of impact the culture and the direction of the church at large?
So the thing that we see happening around a World Conference resolution is reflective of what's happening in the life of the church. It's in response to contemporary happenings, crises, as well as, you know, good times, bad times, shifts in culture, shifts in knowledge, you know, what is humanity discovering in any given time, new information that impacts how we understand our world, how we understand our role in that world, it can also reflect, you know, deepening biblical scholarship, interpretation of scripture, all those kinds of things. So it reflects what's happening in the life of the church, as well as how prophetic leadership in the church is understanding God's call to us in any specific time and place. So it's this tension of the in-between of life as we are living it in that time and place, as well as how we're understanding God to be leading us and calling us to live and become at the same time. So World Conference resolutions can be sponsored by the First Presidency or leading council quorums of the church, as well as they can emerge from the grassroots level and come up through, you know, back then it would have been districts and states, and now it's through mission centers. So that reflects how the people, and we would understand the people of the church to be prophetic people, how the prophetic impulse is being lived out at the grassroots level and lift to the importance that we want the body of the church, the global body of the church, to consider things we see as being important to not only the life of the church, but the life of God's people of faith. So, you know, every generation has to answer the question, what does it mean to be the people of God in this time and this place? And so World Conference resolutions, whether they're coming from the leading quorums or they're coming from the field, reflect our response to that question. So those things that are brought to the legislative sessions in the context of a World Conference are debated, discussed, and voted upon, and those that are approved reflect the sense that the body as a whole is saying, yes, this is important to us, and we will make that a resolution, and different resolutions may have policy associated with it, which help implement any directive in a resolution. Sometimes there is not policy related to it, but it may result in forming a special team or committee to focus on the content of that, provide educational resources, and in some way, shape, or form, help the body begin to live into what that resolution is saying to the church. So it's really interesting, I think, to go through and read all these resolutions over the course of our time as a people of faith and see how our understanding of the nature of God and who God is calling us to become is refined. Maybe we turn the dial and get more clarity on certain aspects of that. I think it's really exciting. And how we live out common consent takes on life through that process.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think that that helps clarify exactly how peace is implemented in the church through World Conference resolutions, that it actually matters. It's not just people bringing forth a little document and we talk about it and then forget about it, but that there's actual impact that these resolutions bring, and it can shift and change, or like you said, turn the dial on certain things that the church will be focusing on, whether that comes from leadership or whether that comes from the people in the field. I think that's really significant. So thank you for clarifying that.
Sure thing. The other thing that I've seen in my life, which is, even though I'm what some people would call an older adult, is I've had about 20 years of actively attending world conferences now. And it's interesting to see certain world conference resolutions that had a statement, but it wasn't associated necessarily with specific actions, and how the world conference, the body of the church, will pick up certain things that they think are really important and make a new resolution years later that puts hands and feet on it, that includes a directive of how they think we should address that in the life of the church. And oftentimes that has to do with education and awareness or a specific task force associated with it. So that's another trail to follow as we march down our history of world conference, general conferences over the years.
Fascinating. We could spend a lot of time doing that, but today we're talking about peace.
So I want to talk about Apostle Charles Neff. He was an apostle from 1958 to 1984, and his leadership really impacted some of the changes that we see happening in the 1960s forward. He was a missionary, and he had a lot of impact on the mission and theology of the reorganized church in lots of different ways. He also founded the humanitarian agency Outreach International, which is very well known and very active today, and the Community One Resources Development Inc., which is known as CORD. So you hear a lot about CORD in the Philippines, for example. So those two agencies, institutions, nonprofit institutions are alive and thriving today, and he was responsible for that. He was responsible for starting the church in Japan, South Korea, Philippines, India, Nigeria, Liberia, and Kenya. And so this was at the very beginning of the reorganization, going global in a new way into new countries. And also, this was associated with the missionary work that challenged Charles Neff and in turn Community of Christ to rethink the church's theology in ways that opened it to the voices of other cultures. And also, Charles Neff, on the front line of that missionary work, found himself confronted with horrific realities of massive poverty. So getting out of the U.S. context and being confronted with just expanded, horrific details of poverty that we don't see in the U.S. He grew up in a poor family in the U.S. in Hardin, Missouri. He also served in World War II in the Navy in the Pacific. And his time in World War II had a massive impact on his worldview as well. So Neff believed that the entire gospel and church doctrine could be boiled down to two essential non-negotiable principles. And that was the reality of a personal God and the worth of humans. So we understand the worth of humans today in our enduring principle, the worth of all persons, which has deep roots in the Restoration and particularly in Community of Christ. Charles Neff felt that the church's mission to incarnate these principles took place through social development, religious witness, and political activism. So he had a few key points. I just want to share those. He was really focused on community. That was a really big thing for him. And of course, that was really critical to the movement from the beginning. And community and the importance of community just has continued to take on deeper life and meaning and understanding in the life of the church. He felt like it was absolutely fundamental that we understand that our life as Christian disciples is not just about us as individuals, but is about us as a collective social group of people, and in the context of that interaction, not just between us as disciples and Community of Christ, but our interaction with all of society across the globe is fundamental to what it means to be a church and mission faithful to the living Christ. He also was keenly attuned to the importance of indigenization and cultural sensitivity. So I think Neff was one of the first that realized that the liberating truths of the gospel are best expressed through indigenous culture and context. So language, symbol, meaning, all of the things that people use to communicate and live out how they understand God. needs to be enculturated in who they are authentically. In other words, he helped us understand that the restoration movement was not intended to be imported as American culture into other parts of the world, that the message, the essence of Christ's message, lives in all contexts and cultures, and we do a disservice if we import our own culture on top of that message. And that in the process of that, recognizing Indigenous leaders all over the world and how they can be carriers of the message and interpreters of the gospel to the benefit of the whole church. So we have something to learn from each other in the context of each other's cultures. He also focused on liberation for the poor and the dispossessed. And so he was aware of liberation theology. He appreciated what liberation theology has to say about what it means to follow the Christ. And he understood, I think, in a very deep and personal way, what we see in the New Testament lived out through Jesus and in God's preferential treatment awareness of the poor. He had a focus on human equality. So if we look back at what's happening in the world around us in the 60s and 70s and even the 80s, we see a lot of, you know, racial inequality, understanding in an American culture, the civil rights movement and what that was trying to do and the importance of that to us as a people of faith, and then also, you know, women's rights later on. So he really was trying to break down the walls that divide and help us understand the deep meaning of the worth of all persons and how that pushes against the human tendencies to stratify society and label and rank people according to, you know, their color, their class, gender, all kinds of things. And then lastly, and this of course was highly impacted by his time in World War II and then seeing violence firsthand in different parts of the country, but he had a very anti-militarism stance. So he would be bringing us into understanding what it means to be a non-violent people, or to understand that to truly live into a global sense of peace, that conversation, dialogue needs to be a first response as opposed to a military response of violence and weapons. And so, you know, he was also living during the advent of nuclear warfare and the impact that had when we use those in the world, the devastation that it perpetuated across not just humanity, but all creation and the health and welfare of our planet. I also want, I've talked about this a little bit, but I think it's important to understand what was going on in the world at the same time that, you know, Charles Neff was serving in the Council of 12, and we begin to see World Conference resolutions in response to this, and I want to share what some of those resolutions were in just a moment. But we are going through, as a people, we're going through a deepening awareness and appreciation of our Christian heritage and realizing our place in that circle, so the greater Christian tradition. You see this reflected in 161:1b. Of course, this came in the 90s, but claim your unique and sacred place within the circle of those who call upon the name of Jesus Christ. Be faithful to the spirit of the restoration, mindful that it is a spirit of adventure, openness, and searching. So in the 60s, early 70s, we were really beginning to explore what this Christian tradition was, this greater heritage that we came out of, and understanding that we were not separate from that. We emerged out of that, and that understanding that journey and history, the history of the Christian faith and theology, had a lot to say to us, and it helped us understand not only where we came from, but who we are in the context of that. So that was a really big thing happening during this time. We also are going out into many different nations, as I said, and we're exposed to systemic oppression and injustice all over the world. We're faced during this same time with the new Mormon history coming out, you know, credible historical scholarship, bringing more information, some of which was very uncomfortable to receive. And that meant we began our journey as a people of recognizing some truths that we might prefer not to face at all. So there was a lot of disruption during that time in regards to our own heritage and roots. And then in the U.S., we have the civil rights movement and the intersectionality of that movement with second wave feminism. We have the sexual revolution. We have globally, the earth, the whole world is experiencing second wave feminism. In the U.S., we have riots at Kent State University. We have peace sit-ins all over the place. This is in the context of the Vietnam War. We have nuclear disarmament activism, and the world is becoming like this pressure cooker of social justice awareness and activism. So all of that is going on in the context of W. Wallace Smith's prophet presidency, Charles Neff, who is doing tons of work in this area. If we look at World Conference resolutions, we see things like 1064, tribute to Martin Luther King in 1968. 1075, gospel to racial and ethnic groups, also in 1968. We see World Conference Resolution 1087, peace, war, and the use of force in 1970. So we're beginning to experience this kind of push me, pull you understanding around war. Lots of talk about just war, lots of talk about non-violence during this time. World Conference 1148 in 1978, we have the World Hunger Fund. So that provided for a program to be established that would facilitate opportunities for those interested and motivated to participate in additional ways beyond the fasting discipline, and to add these funds to the support ministries that were directed specifically towards problems of world hunger. So early in our tradition, we had, you know, oblation and fasting Sunday, and those funds, you know, were always collected to help aid the poor. This was going to be a bigger emphasis based on, you know, that guiding principle and traditional practice, and really put some hands and feet on it, so to speak. So that was in 78. And then first presidency in 1979 officially established the World Hunger Fund, which continues to this day. Then in 78, Wallace B. Smith's ordained prophet president, and lots of exciting things just began to take off. So in 1982, the World Church Peace and Justice Team is organized, and that is specifically to pursue issues that cross jurisdictional boundaries that are of importance to the worldwide church. So we're beginning to see that this kind of siloed type of apostolic field approach is good to have focus on particular contexts and cultures of the church and to support that. But at the same time, we need to have a very interrelated, interdependent, interconnected dialogue going on with all of the church, because a lot of issues are global issues, and we can do a lot more good if we approach that as a team and then bring it home, so to speak, to specific fields. So let me stop there, Brittany. Do you have any questions before I launch into other kinds of things that are beginning to emerge in the life of the church?
I mean, I don't know if I have questions, but I am reminded of why I enjoyed listening to you that night at reunion so much, because it's fascinating to me, because as I hear you speaking, what I think about is the fact that at IHQ headquarters in Independence, they were kind of theologically breaking apart what does the gospel mean. And then people like Charles Neff, I'm sure there were many others, that were actually encountering that in the flesh. You know, they were actually in the field having kind of a parallel experience of, okay, we need to re-examine what Christ's mission is, what the purpose of Christianity is, and all these things, and kind of maybe break them apart from Americana culture and maybe even a little bit of the prosperity gospel, which I think can be, you know, the idea that the restoration has elements of the prosperity gospel, I think is an argument that can be made. But when you're in the field faced with abject poverty and what does the gospel actually mean to these people when you can't promise them all these things that maybe other Christian denominations are promising them. Like it's just interesting that field ministers were really being faced with that reality at the same time that we had other church leadership going to seminary and kind of breaking apart that new Mormon history, and on a theological level, maybe coming to the same conclusions that a lot of field people were coming to, which I think is just really fascinating because they were both happening at the same time. So I don't know. It's really interesting to me. So that's not really a question. It's just an observation.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm reminded, even as I'm reviewing and studying things about this, what does it mean, peace then and now, historically and now, and the in-between time, just going over all these things. I love this sense of, we have some historical perspective now and kind of stand back, but to look back over time and see how God is having God's way with us. I mean, inviting us into these new mission adventures across the world, and what stares us back in the face, as well as pulling us into deeper theological study and reflection. And it's amazing. And then how that lives out in the life of the people, and how it not only comes out in World Conference resolutions, but, you know, another way to see this emerging focus is to read the Doctrine and Covenants and to see how it comes to us through continuing revelation.
I love it too. I've also heard people mention that you can kind of trace that by looking at past hymnals as well over mm-hmm. the course, you know, since the 50s, 60s, and then just take a look at the songs that are in each and every hymnal since then. You can kind of see the development and the new understanding, the expanded understanding of who we are and what Christ's mission is.
Yes, absolutely. You see the theological understanding reflected. And I think most poignant in our most recent hymnal, Community Christ Sings, is this expanded sense of diverse culture, and claiming that and singing it through indigenous languages and hymnody. Okay, so let's, we have Wallace B. Smith, 1978, and we're gonna march on into that era. And we had the 1982 World Church Peace and Justice Team established in 1982, which is super important because that becomes for our church this kind of vigilant, intentional focus on peace and justice and how we can continue to be actively engaged with that pursuit in the context of being a faith community. So we see in 1982, at that same time, World Conference Resolution 1177, which was just titled Peace and superseded resolutions 1052, 1087, and 1129. So sometimes we go back into our past and we resend resolutions, or we collect a bunch together and say, okay, that's all going to be subsumed under this new resolution. And that's what that did. And that same year, 1178 nuclear arms reduction. So there's a lot of awareness of nuclear warfare or the capacity for nuclear armament. And then in 1984, we have Section 156. And this was huge. You know, I don't think we can overstate the importance of Section 156 in the life of the church. So that revelation in Doctrine and Covenants does two really important things. It says, now is the time to build this temple in Jackson County that has been, you know, prophesied for so long. The temple lot was staked out by Joseph Smith. We see different expressions of the Restoration Church making claim. Some hold title to pieces of it. We had a little portion, others had parts of it. And here in 1984 is it's time to do it. And it talks about what this will be. It will be an ensign of peace dedicated to the pursuit of peace, reconciliation, and healing of the spirit. So this icon of what it means to be a restoration people, and specifically the reorganization, is going to be built. And I love the fact that it says ensign of peace. So it goes all the way back to the Fishing River Revelation that used that same language of ensign of peace. And it talks about what that's going to mean in the life of the church. And then in that same revelation, it calls for the ordination of women, which is this incredibly powerful and highly debated shift in understanding gender and priesthood, ordained ministry, in the life of the church. So it's, we're going to build this ensign for peace, and at the same time, we're going to make this huge step forward in social justice in the society we live in. I think that's huge, and it continues, I think, continues to speak to us as a people, as we live into the meaning of temple as an ensign of peace, and how it's called us to really stretch ourselves and disrupt our lives in all kinds of peace and justice social issues that we encounter. So in 1984, the Human Rights Team is established. So the Human Rights Team and the Peace and Justice Team are two really critical teams in the life of the church. The Human Rights Team has done work that brings us face-to-face with human trafficking, and establishing a human trafficking project has brought us to dialogue and movement and advocacy related to international immigration issues. We just march on down through the 80s, and in 1986, we had resolutions on domestic violence. We had one on another one on human rights. We had one on apartheid. In 1988, we have one on racism. That same year, we have a day of prayer and fasting for peace. In 1990, we established a temple ministries for peace and justice, even though the temple is not completed yet. And in 1992, we have a resolution on children's advocacy, as well as the Earth Stewardship Team. So we see another team established. We have the Human Rights Team and the Peace and Justice Team, and now we're going to have an Earth Stewardship Team. And that would speak to our enduring principle, sacredness of creation. So we see our mission is beginning to really be aligned with our identity as peacemakers, as a people who are partnering with God to accomplish the cause and purpose of Zion on this planet. So that was 1992. In 1993, the building of the temple is completed. We have the dedication in 1994. And now we have this symbol that reaches up into the sky with a very unique design, an ensign of peace. And with the dedication of the temple, we are now invited to full on give expression to being peacemakers through, you know, flesh and blood. We are going to incarnate the gospel with a new sense of purpose and call. So the Daily Prayer for Peace, of course, is started in December 1993. And on that day was the first peace colloquy at the temple. And the peace colloquy and the award, the World Church Peace Award, has been given every year since then, with the exception of 2 years, the 1993, the Community of Christ International Peace Award began. In 1995, we have the Peace Pavilion, which was formerly the Children's Peace Pavilion, housed in the auditorium, and now it's housed in a separate facility just behind the temple parking lot. In 1998, we have a resolution 1258 with an international ban on landmines. And that same year, in 1998, we see the appointment of Andrew Bolton to a peace and justice minister. So you can see how we kind of build these layers of integrity in response to being peacemakers. And having a full-time minister dedicated to that focus made such a huge impact in the life of the church. And of course, Andrew Bolton continues to be a very active advocate for peace and justice even after his retirement. In 2000, we have a resolution on personal use of firearms. In 2002, sexual abuse of children. 2002, ecumenical and interfaith ministries team. So that was a big one, because that is bumping up against our one true church, which we had begun to reframe our identity from being a one true church to being a faithful expression of the one true God. In other words, we want to be a true and right expression and reflection of God's presence in the world. And part of our old one true church paradigm was, you know, you can't really be ecumenical and interfaith if you're just like the only real one true expression of God on the planet. And really, in the early years, and even in my childhood, we didn't really partner with other Christian faiths at all. And certainly joining into an official association was seen as taboo. And even when we were received and accepted to be a member of the National Council of Churches here in the U.S., we still had people in the church thinking, oh my gosh, this is, you know, we're going down the slippery slope to do this. But what we've realized is that to pursue peace on earth, we are called to be in relationship with all those organizations, and especially religious organizations that have common understanding of a call to be part of establishing peace and justice on our planet. So that actually has been very well aligned missionally with who we understand ourselves to be in the context of the world today. In 2010, we had the resolution on human trafficking, which I told you came out of human rights team. 2013, supporting indigenous and minority peoples. That same year, an action toward nuclear weapons abolition. So we continue to be very aware of nuclear, the potential of nuclear destruction on our planet. That same year, we also established the Health and Wholeness Team, which I think has been an important step to really embracing the integrated understanding of physical and spiritual in the context of our life as disciples of Jesus Christ. I think, you know, the word of wisdom speaks to us in the context of the enduring principle, responsible choices, understanding our bodies, the natural world, and how our spirituality is integrated into that, that God is a God of wholeness and full integration of body, mind, soul, and spirit. The diversity and inclusion team, which we have now, also upholds the worth of persons and speaks to this unity and diversity in the global community of faith that benefits from the beautiful dimensions of diversity that we see in the faces and peoples of our planet. And at the same time, the expression of being one in Christ. In 2016, we have Palestine and Israel resolution and also opposition to predatory loan practices. The African American Ministries team was established around the same time as the diversity and inclusion team. And then this last conference in 2019, we had the domestic and sexual violence resolution and also the nonviolence resolution, which is picking up on some of the past focus and resolution of the church and putting hands and feet to it. So that's a call to really not only hold up nonviolence as something to integrate into our everyday life in conflict resolution, but also as cities, nations, world powers, and begin to intentionally address awareness and education in the body of the church, and to bring some contextual understanding to what nonviolence means in different places of the earth. In the U.S., we largely do not have to live in the context of violence going on all around us. And I'm talking about armed violence, not necessarily domestic abuse, which we certainly face. But we have sisters and brothers in the church that every day, right outside their front door, there's armed warfare happening. And what does nonviolence look like in that context? How do we work towards nonviolent resolution to very complex issues that face us in our world today? So let me pause there for any questions, and then I just want to wrap up with some commentary from another peacemaker who's connected with the church.
Yeah, as you were listing off all the things that the church has been involved with in more recent years, a lot of them I think could be or are seen as political. And I know that there's kind of a pushback against many people about religions and churches getting involved in politics. But I guess I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that, because the reality is often making is political, because violence is often political. And so, I'm wondering what your thoughts are. How do we as a church, whether it's ministers in the church, disciples in the church, or the church at large, how do we kind of walk that line? And is it a line we need to walk? Or is that just the reality that if we're dealing with peace, issues of peace, then we're going to brush up against politics?
I would say, Brittany, that issues of faith are always political. We live in a context where we have governments, different nations have governments. We have city and state governments as well as national government in the U.S. We recognize that there are all different kinds of forms of government across the globe. So living out our faith is always going to connect with the political arena. Certainly, the enduring principle, responsible choices, would call us to understand our faith, how we understand the nature of God, how we understand who God is calling us to be and become in this world. Responsible choices would also call us to understand the context and culture of where we live, what kinds of challenges we face in our cities and nations, and what voice do we have in our form of government, and how do we make responsible choices in the arena of government, laws of the land, that would be consistent with our understanding of our faith and who we're called to be. So I don't think there's any way around being political in our faith. We live in a nation that has become very highly polarized politically, and that brings with it a lot of strong feelings and opinions. And sometimes in the context of our church community, we find ourselves holding different opinions along that perspective. I think a key principle in dialogue is the worth of all persons. So how do we share our opinions and maintain our respect and integrity and regard for the worth of all persons? How do we talk about very polarizing topics and maintain integrity and esteem for one another? So I think that's something that Community of Christ has had to learn how to do as we talk about divisive issues like gender, the ordination of women, inclusion for LGBTQIA, etc., and other, arms, immigration. There are all kinds of divisive issues that we talk about in the life of the church. And I would say, Jesus was definitely in the hotbed of politics in his life and time. And this conflict of power had a lot to do with how he ended up on the cross. So I just, Jesus was politically radical in his day and time, and not just in the Roman Empire, but in the life of his church, the Judaic culture, the Jewish faith. So I think we walk a line very carefully. We do our very best to uphold and respect one another in the context of that journey. We recognize that there's always a tension between life and understanding how God is calling us to walk forward. So we have one foot in the muck and mess of life and the other foot firmly planted in the center of Christ, God revealed through Jesus Christ, made known to us through the continuing presence of the Holy Spirit. And I think to be full on engaged in following the Christ gets messy sometimes. And that always touches politics.
Thanks. I really appreciate that answer. And, like you said, it's not necessarily U.S. politics that we're brushing up against. It's cultures and politics from everywhere that the church is at, which, I think we've seen play out at different times at World Conference and different points in history, that because we are a global church, it's, again, not just the 1950s Americana culture that we're dealing with. So that the reality is that the gospel just kind of busts through all of that, and political parties that we see in America, it's a lot more involved and a lot more expansive. So it's good to keep in mind. So thank you.
Certainly. I wanted to end with just sharing some things that I read in a 2009 Saints Herald blog online from Matthew Bolton, who's the son of Andrew Bolton. And he is kind of pushing back on Community of Christ and inviting us to consider, what does it look like if we really are serious about peace? And what kind of fruits might that bear? This was written in 2009, so I think, we see some of these things we've begun to talk about. He talks about what he might expect to see if we were actually bearing fruit in a serious way. He talks about seeing a commitment to nonviolence and non-participation in military or armed factions. Certainly our most recent nonviolence resolution this year is pulling us into that same place. He would hope to see widespread participation in peace groups at the local congregational level. We used to have a lot of peace clubs across the church. I haven't done a recent assessment on that, but it would be interesting to know how engaged we are in peace groups at the local congregational level. He thinks it would be a great idea if we had peace and justice offices at the United Nations and in Washington, D.C. I thought that was really insightful, and how that could help keep us informed about national and international peace issues and help us educate our members and, in a sense, begin to influence policy. He would hope to see a substantial engagement with national peace-building efforts in conflicted countries where the church has a significant presence. When he was writing, he was thinking about places like Haiti, Sri Lanka, and Philippines, Democratic Republic of the Congo. We could certainly add lots of different areas to that list now. He talked about posting World Service Corps volunteers to conflict and post-conflict zones. So World Service Corps internships that actually were sent to areas that need support in the way of peace-building activities and walking with, you know, vulnerable populations, informing human rights campaigns, etc. He talked about the possibility of offering entities like the UN or the US State Department space in the auditorium or the temple to offer that space as a meeting place, to host peace negotiations, etc. Really allowing our concrete buildings to be a space that's utilized not just by us for focus on peace, but other organizations that are engaged in peace. He talked about having a peace studies major at Graceland University, and he noted they currently have a minor. I ran a search on that when I first read this, and I think it still is a minor and not a major, but a great idea, I think, to have something offered as a major content of study and degree program at Graceland University. He talked about sponsoring prominent peace scholars in residence at the temple who could hold public seminars and write articles, maybe work with church leaders on education and information about ways to build peace in the areas that we serve. Talked about dedicating efforts to get involved with the ecumenical and interfaith movement at the local, national, and international levels. Now, we have made progress on that one as far as being a member of the NCC here in the U.S. There are lots of different ways to do that globally. And I think our participation in the Parliaments of World Religions has been notable in recent years as well. In 2015 in Salt Lake City and then in Toronto, I can't remember if that was this year or last year, but having a presence there. And then the last thing he talks about is having a particular attention to peace building in the Holy Land of the Middle East, an important calling he sees for all members of the three Abrahamic religions, Jewish, Christian, and Islam. So I really appreciated Matthew Bolton's perspectives on deeper ways, additional ways that we as a faith movement, community of Christ, can put hands and feet on our understanding of truly being peacemakers in the world today, of helping realize God's dream for the world, God's vision of peace, of Zion, here and now in our earth, in ways that truly bring peace, reconciliation, and healing of the spirit.
So I guess, Robin, what I'm wondering about is what is necessarily stopping us from doing some of those things that Andrew suggests on his blog? I mean, if this was written in 2009, you noted where we have made some progress, but is it mostly just a resource, like a problem of resource and capacity, or what do you think is holding us back from some of these suggestions?
So I want to make sure that we understand what I just talked about came from Matthew Bolton, not Andrew Bolton.
Oh, Excuse me. Yes.
No worries. No worries. They're both Boltons. I think sometimes we say it's resources, but I think that we have a lot more power in our world than that. And we can look back on lots of peacemakers in the world that had almost no resources at hand to make a difference, who have made huge, powerful differences in the world. I think we're holding ourselves back. I think it's hard. And to be a peacemaker and stand in the gap in the middle of social injustice, it calls us to do things that can be uncomfortable, that can be disruptive in our lives. At times it calls us to stand smack in the face of violence. It's hard. It's hard work. And it's slow going. So to really change systemic oppression, poverty across the globe, it's having the focus, having action plans, and being dedicated and committed to walking that path day after day after day. Now, it's always going to be a series of, you know, two steps forward, one back, or one forward and two back. But it's the long journey in the same direction, which is what mission is a long journey in the same direction. And the more that we can do that as a people, the more impact we can have, which means a lot of individuals in different places all over the world are choosing to take steps into that. So I think the reality is that we identify a step we can take that puts us, even if it's a baby step, out of our comfort zone, and bit by bit, we go forward. And when we recognize powerful peacemakers in the midst of our community, we identify those folks, we empower, equip, and support them so that they can be leaders of our movement and help us find a path forward.
Thank you for that. I was hoping you would say something like that, but I didn't want to fish for it or lead you into it too much. But I'm grateful for what you shared. And I'm grateful for this conversation at large. Like I said at the beginning, it was something that I found a lot of meaning in as I was listening to you as you were first presenting this information. And, you know, I'd heard bits and pieces of the story, but to have it all kind of thrown out there, just one way to track how Community of Christ has been a peace church and maybe how we can further engage in the work of peace was really meaningful and impactful for me. So, and Robin, like you mentioned, we do have a podcast with Locke Mackay that mainly focuses on Joseph III and his response to some of the historical events that had happened to his dad and then how he kind of pulled that peace gene out of those events and his response to some of the horrors that had happened in his childhood. So I think that these two episodes will pair well with each other. And so I'm really glad that you kind of brought it into the 21st century and have given us some meat to chew on of where we can go again or where we can continue to go as a peace church. So thank you so much.
You are very welcome. I just want to raise one more thing, and that is, in response to, you know, what's holding us back or what can we do, is we have a ton of great resources online, largely associated with some of these teams that we have in place, the Peace and Justice Team, the Human Rights Team, the Earth Stewardship Team. They have fantastic stuff and concrete action plans that we can do in our congregation. I mean, I would say a lot of our congregations are small. Just find one thing that you can do that fits your congregation size and your where you're located, relevant to your city and area, and go for it. And you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot out there already. So seeofchrist.org, just put one of these teams in the search engine and explore.
Awesome. Thank you. And maybe we'll put a few of those links in the show notes just to get you started a little bit.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.